Well, what I'd like to do is I'd like to go ahead. We were calling this case presentation part two, and I'd like to really continue where we left off. Which ones of you? Dr. Sully, you were on part one, I believe. Who else was on part one?
Dr. Miller.
Dr. Miller, Jeff, you were on that call. Was there anybody else on the first part?
I was on the first one, Jim Dick.
Okay, you were.
Yeah, Dr. Dick was there. That's correct.
Okay. So what we'll do tonight, first off, what I'd like to do is I would like to entertain questions from the three of you who heard the first part. I don't want to repeat the first part, but I would like to, you know, at least bring the doctors who were not on that call up to speed where we are. And so I will talk for a few moments, and then I'd like to, the three of you, I'd like to entertain some questions. And this is a very informal teleconference. This is sponsored by Quality in Columbia, Missouri, and I really want to thank them for being here. It's also sponsored by Rocket Dog Dental, which is a marketing firm in Seattle, and they do our marketing for us, and they do some really nice things. And if you're looking for marketing, they're fantastic. And I've had several clients rise for one who works with Quality, and they do some excellent lab work. And so you want to remember that when you're looking for a laboratory. And if you're into the cosmetic area, they do just a fantastic job. So really what the whole gist of case presentation, the way we teach this, and you know, I've been teaching case presentation for years on a completely different direction than what most people are doing. And it grew out of working with psychiatrists back when I first started my practice. A group of five of us got together with a psychiatrist. Started out, it was going to be 3 months, and we went to him with the premise of learning how human beings make decisions, since I had no training on that in dental school. And it went on for 2 years, twice a month, and it was a program that, you know, it was just a very informal meeting, but it was really very effective. And what we did is we learned that people make decisions emotionally, that no one ever makes a decision rationally or logically. And so it's all broken down into the right brain and the left brain, and the right side is the emotional side, the side we dream with, the side where we experience emotions. The left side is what all dentists have very heavily developed, and that is the side that got us through physics and comparative anatomy and organic chemistry and got us through dental school. And that's the logical side. It's the side that, you know, we had developed enough to the point that most of us as dentists probably could have been engineers. We probably could have been accountants. We could have been computer nerds. At least in my case, I would have had to have been about 30 years younger to be a computer nerd. But, you know, those are fields that we would have felt real comfortable in. And the only problem is in dentistry, for so many years, we have sold dentistry as a needed service. And, you know, we've actually try and convince people they need their teeth and they need what we do. The problem is the public understands differently, and that has not been tremendously effective. And, you know, I very often throw out ideas that, you know, the American public spends twice as much on big screen TVs as they do on dentistry, and that's when you enter in the amount the insurance companies pay. We spend as much on dog food and pet supplies as we do on dentistry, and so those are some indicators that we're not doing too well. So I started developing this theory years ago that we need to learn to appeal to the right side or the emotions, and we do that by asking questions rather than lecturing. So that's really the thing. And last week I gave you some questions, and we'll go through those questions again tonight. And if any of you are interested in getting a copy of those questions, all you have to do is talk to somebody in our office, and we'll be happy to send those to you. But that's really the gist of it. And the idea is that you don't need anything. And if you think about that premise alone, I was talking to one of my clients last night. Actually, it's a client that I worked with, 15 years ago, and he's not currently a client, but he's getting ready to do a program for the students at Loma Linda, the senior students at Loma Linda. He's a part-time, he teaches one day a week there, one day every other week, and we were just talking about this, and he says, you know, it makes a huge difference when you sit down with the patient in a non-judgmental effort, a non-judgmental way, and just ask questions, find out what they want, and then help them get that. And that's what our questions are really designed to do. Not making people wrong, not making people guilty, not making them feel like they're going to die a slow, painful death called black triangle disease or a wide gray line disease or whatever else it is that we talk to patients about when we're trying to educate them. And I was as much into that educational side as as anybody. You know, I built a whole room in my office for educating patients, and we would bring them in and teach them how to floss their teeth, and we really believed that the only reason people didn't floss their teeth is they didn't know how. So we brought them in 4 or 5 days in a row and taught them each time. They would go home and floss their teeth, and that turned out not to be the case. And so we started looking around to see how we could do it, and that's when the psychiatrist came on board, and we started to learn how to involve the emotions. And that's what we spent last week on primarily. And so what I'd like to do today is take this a little bit further and actually talk of how we teach staff members to do this. You see, if somebody knows how to ask questions, they can sell anything, and they really don't need to know a whole lot about the product, just that the product will do what the prospect wants. You don't have to know the details, you see. So, and interesting enough, I know that some of you have read our book, Playing Your A Game, and there is a doctor in the book, Lori Kemet, whose husband sells all the dentistry in the office. And when we first started to work with them, he was not really selling the dentistry at that time. He was involved in the office, and he has a complete non-dental background. And when we suggested he could sell the dentistry, he was a little concerned. He said, "I don't even know the tooth numbers." And I said, "Well, that's good. I don't want you to learn the tooth numbers either, because if you know tooth numbers, you all know what he'll talk about. He'll talk about tooth numbers, and tooth number so and so, we're going to do this, and number this, and that's not what sells." Well, interesting thing is, without knowing anything about dentistry, and without even knowing tooth numbers, although that's a little facetious, he does know tooth numbers. Last year, they broke $3 million.
Wow.
And that's an office that, they have about 4 staff members, and they do exceptionally well. But they're selling that without spending any time talking about dental procedures. And you wonder, well, how can they do that? Well, that's the problem. And that's the problem most of us get into, is we talk about the procedures rather than what the patients want. So I'm going to start by asking some of you that were on the call the last time. We went through the questions. What have you, and Mike also, Mike Bannon, you were on the call last time too, I believe. What have you done with these questions? I mean, that's really what matters. So I'm going to ask Jim, Dr. Dick first. What have you had a chance to use any of these questions?
Yeah, I have. I transcribed my notes last time and distributed them to the staff, and we have used some of those. I wouldn't say that we've implemented them extremely successful, but
uh-huh.
I can say that it's changed our perspective and been very helpful.
Yeah, good. How did your staff react to stop lecturing and ask questions?
Staff was already... talk positively about my experience when I saw you in Hinman, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, and
uh-huh.
was impressed. And so they've pretty well heard it before.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the detail that I was able to, bring them up to after last week,
uh-huh.
the last conference.
Good. So you started asking some of the questions. Dr. Sully, how'd you do with them?
We've been asking questions for a long time, so those kind of questions are kind of questions that we normally ask.
Mm-hmm.
We've been Excellent. Through boot camp, we've been through a number of things, and
mm-hmm.
I find the questions extraordinarily helpful.
Yeah.
Because we end up, like you say, not talking about procedures really at all. It's just feelings that we're talking about.
Yeah.
How are you going to feel if we get this done?
Mm-hmm.
And then once they decide how they feel about it, the details don't matter anymore.
Right. Yeah, the concept that if we're going to do business, we'll work out the details, and if we're not going to do business, the details don't matter. And that's an incredible premise right there, that we don't have to know the details. We'll work the details out.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff, you were on the call last time. Did you start using these questions some?
Yeah, just a sidebar. My son made a comment one time about how, Dad, you lecture too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what I was doing at the office. I was lecturing.
Uh-huh.
And I think my son is very intuitive in what he was saying.
Yeah.
And so my staff made a comment that you're talking with them more than talking at them. So
yes.
So I uh-huh. it's just I'm not good at it yet, but I'm starting to get the concept.
Well, it's a whole new way to do it, and it's a shift, and actually it's even a shift from the questions we were asking a few years ago, in that we get much further along in the sales process. And one of the things that happens in the offices we work with, and Mike Bannon, you will start to experience this as you get the right people in place and get to the next seminar, you will find that your staff will pick up on these questions and start to ask these questions. And the sad part, that's sad, but the part that bothers some dentists is we really don't need you to sell these cases. And when we get the doctor down to a point where we can actually get the team to start selling the dentistry all the way to literally picking up a check before they even meet you. Now, some doctors feel a little threatened by that, I suppose, but after they check their bank account, they probably get over it pretty quickly. But if you all have a copy of the book and read that, you will find that Jeff Bailey, Lori Kemet's husband, literally has picked up checks on several occasions before they even meet the doctor. And I know in an office, Rise 4, up in Seattle, who happens to be my dentist, listening to his receptionist, Maria, several times, I've heard her actually arrange lines of credit through Care Credit for a patient before they even show up in the office. So she talks to them all the way through. In their case, they do a lot of cosmetics and a lot of large cases. That's pretty much all they do. But on the cosmetic side, it fits perfectly. But even for general dentistry and even for implants and the other things that we do, it works just fine. But she talks to them all the way through money and how they can make arrangements on that sort of thing before they start. So what I'd like to do then is ask questions from where we started last time and kind of go that way for a little bit. Any one of the four of you who were on the call last time, what are questions that came up after the last time we talked?
Insurance is a big area of discussion around my office. It seems that we have a lot of patients who just want to maximize their insurance and come in with the idea that they're not going to spend much, if any, out of pocket. And, mm-hmm. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about that, focusing on that.
You and your team spend a lot of time talking, or you spend a lot of time talking to the patients about that?
Yeah, the team does.
Spending a lot of time with patients.
Yeah, it just seems that it's always an issue, very uh-huh. frequently an issue, and something that we're forced into, explaining and justifying and so forth. Where the patients really don't want it, aren't willing to pay for it yet, don't see the value,
Okay, we'll talk about that tonight. What else? Anybody else?
Yeah, that's always a common theme anywhere you practice dentistry, mm-hmm. is insurance. And a lot of people, they want the crown of the year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a case where you need six anterior yeah. crowns, and you'll have someone say, well, I'm covered for one crown.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, that's not the proper treatment. If you want
yeah.
to maximize the benefit, show them the value is the key thing. But you're right, a lot of us get hung up on the insurance aspect.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. In Canada or the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the Crown of the Year Club is a term my wife coined one time. She wrote an article for Dental Economics.
Mm-hmm.
We called it How to Break the Crown of the Year Club, and that was the dentist and the hygienist who basically double-team the patient, and we do it fairly effectively, but we, you know, as we're cleaning the patient's teeth, the hygienist starts the conversation, mm-hmm. how's the crown we did for you last year, and well, it's fine, as I'm cleaning your teeth, I just couldn't help but notice that there's one opposite out on the mouth. It looks just like the one did last year just before it broke, and the doctor would probably recommend a crown on that. Well, since we have insurance, we'll pay 50% of one crown. That's 100% sale, and we think we've done a great job.
Mm-hmm.
So we call that the Crown of the Year Club, and that's probably, you know, one of the reasons the laboratories like to have me do these sessions is that
mm-hmm.
95% of all crown bridge is done one tooth at a time. Now, that's probably hard for some of you in this call to believe. You've moved beyond that, but that is actual facts. I've spoken to several laboratory owners associations, and they assure me that that's basically what goes on. Now, there are some laboratories that specialize in larger cases. Quality, for one, is not one that does 95% single teeth. They do lots of large cases and lots mm-hmm. of cosmetic cases. But 95%, that's how it's done. So, yeah, we'll talk about how to get out of that. And the basic answers to both those answers, well, I'll make it. Is there anybody other questions before I go ahead? Jeff, you were on here last month. What do you say?
Well, that is a big issue, and I guess involving the staff and getting them to do more of this is something that I really want to get into.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How to involve the staff.
Where they can, you know, cut your time down that you have to spend, and also, you know, develop relationships with the patient, which is certainly critical.
Right. David Wilson, what would you say? What were questions you would have?
I don't have any right now. It's okay. Nelson, not Wilson, but
I didn't hear you. Nelson, I'm sorry. I misunderstood completely. I apologize. I said Wilson, and you said Nelson. You would probably know better than I would. So you're
okay.
I corrected on my paper.
Yes. We had gone through the same insurance issues that the other doctors have. My wife works at the front desk, and she's on the patients right away describing that the insurance is just a benefit to add value, but it won't pay for all your dental work.
Yes, okay.
They've attended to some of our programs, and they're starting the program, too, just a reminder.
Oh, good. That's right. I knew that. When is your summit, David?
It's in February at the midwinter meeting.
Oh, good. Okay. So I have here. Okay, good.
Bill, it's Mike Sully. I've got a question.
Yes.
What I'd like to know is how you transmit to the staff this global sense that you're talking about getting beyond a single crown.
Okay.
As far as is, how do you get them to understand that there's a bigger picture? I mean, would you suggest to go through and say, let's treatment plan cases together and let's explore options or...
Excellent. I can spend the rest of the evening on that question.
Well, that's where our biggest struggle is.
And I think, actually, that question is probably the question that will probably include these other things as well.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else from Charles? Anything from you?
No.
You did ask a question, didn't you? You asked a second question about the crown.
Sure, just along the lines of the insurance and, you know, doing one crown a year type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the question which the other gentleman just asked, that's a very good question to answer.
Mm-hmm. Mike, we talked a little bit to you, and when I was speaking to you and your wife the last couple times, we talked a little bit about case presentation. Have you had a chance at all to try this at all?
I've been sitting here quietly because I wasn't on that previous call, so I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, I was thinking you and I covered a little bit of that, and I suggested the other day that you listen to those tapes on creating value. And
which I haven't received yet.
Oh, you haven't? Okay. Well, you're still early in the program. So.
Yeah.
They should be at the one office. I think they should have arrived today.
Yeah, so I'll be up there tomorrow and get those
dig in. Well, let's talk a little bit about this, and I think these are all excellent questions. And I think the first issue is a leadership issue, and that's really what we're talking about, how to transmit this, as you call it, global sense of treatment and really what we're trying to accomplish. And I think that is the key. For those of you that have read The E-Myth by Michael Gerber or heard about the book of Michael Gerber, here's something to keep in mind. The gist of the book is that Gerber and his associates, they went out. The title of the book is The E-Myth, E as an entrepreneur. And what they did is they studied people that went into small businesses, and the myth was that people went into small business to start a business. But what they found was that most people, as a matter of fact, they found 85% of people in small business actually went into and remained at the technician level. In other words, they enjoyed doing the thing that business does, whether it was baking pies, being a carpenter, working on cars, working on teeny tiny white things in a dark, wet space. And they found that they remained at the technician level. Now, at the technician level, and that's where most of us as dentists were attracted into dentistry. We were good in science. We were good with our hands. We had some inkling of being a helper to other people, and so we went into fields like dentistry, and most of us actually end up staying at that technician level. And so trying to get across to a group of people like team members what we're trying to do is difficult. So they found 85% there. They found that 10% actually embraced the management of that business. In other words, in dentistry, we can take it to a level and say, you know, there are some doctors out there that do $800,000 a year, and they have 75% overhead, and other doctors do $400,000 at 50% overhead. and they both make exactly the same amount of money at the end of the day, and yet the one is doing twice as much dentistry. And, of course, that's the dentist that does not have the time to look at the numbers, work with the staff, educate the staff. They don't have time to do that, but they have time to do twice as much dentistry. But that's where they're comfortable, is more comfortable hands in the mouth doing dentistry than they are managing and educating staff. But then what Gerber found, about 5% actually embraced the leadership of that business. And that's pretty typical of everyone in business. They actually only about 5% embraced the leadership. And Tom Peters, who is a business professor out of Stanford, has written several books. One was In Search of Excellence. His last book is excellent. It's called Reimagining. But Tom Peters said that most corporations are underled and overmanaged, and I find that to be completely true in dental offices. Is we spend a lot of time at the technician level, we spend a lot of time at the management level, but we don't spend any time at all on the leadership side. How do you get a staff to embrace this idea of more than one tooth at a time? And I think the idea is you have to create a vision of where you're headed. What is it you're trying to accomplish? And I think that's up to you. You've got to come up with some kind of a statement. And then what we're going to do is watch your actions to see if you actually follow that. But once the staff gets that what we're trying to do is not always pathological for patients, it's not pathology-based, it's based on the patient's wants and desires and their emotional needs, sometimes more than their clinical needs. And the only way to find that out, you see, is to pretend you're Sergeant Schultz. Remember from the old Hogan's Heroes, I know nothing. And this goes back a couple thousand years, if you think about it. I mean, Aristotle was, or Socrates was one of the first people to say, and I think the quote was something that when you assume you know something, you stop asking questions, mm-hmm. and when you stop asking questions, you stop learning. So if you think about that quote just for a moment, and that's what I say, this information has been out there for a long time. Team members and doctors take on an assumption that we know something, and if I forget about Sergeant Schultz and I make an assumption that I know something based on my training and my experience clinically, and now I start presenting treatment to the patient based on what I think they need, mm-hmm. you see it's going to be all pathological based, or pathology based, and if staff sees us doing that, then they're going to copy what we do. If you're going to get past that and find out what patients' long-term goals are and find out how they want their teeth, say, 20 years from now, and of course, you're going to get answers, well, just like they are now or, you know, that sort of thing. You've got to know where to go there. If you stop there and say, okay, I know what that means, boom, and now we start talking, we're in trouble. So we have to find out, well, what do they mean by that? You might mention, well, you know, my grandmother had her teeth her whole life. She had them in a jar beside the bed every night. Is that what you mean? Well, no, that's not what I mean. Well, what do you mean? Well, I want my natural teeth in my mouth. And I you know, well, that's probably going to be exactly the case. That's very possible. And today that should be the case. Tell me a bit more about that. And then you get the patient talking. And that's really what you want to do. Remember, Sergeant Schultz would know nothing. And so... Mm-hmm. You keep asking questions and you keep deepening that experience. You might ask questions, well, tell me a little about your history of your family. For example, did your parents have their teeth their whole life? And you just play with whatever comes up. And, well, yeah, they had most of their teeth. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, I know they were missing some teeth. I'm sorry to hear that. How did you know that? How did that come up in family conversation, or how as a child did you know that your parents only had part of their teeth? And you'll get stories about, well, my father had quite a few teeth missing, and I know he was embarrassed about it because he was guarded as he spoke, or he never smiled in family photographs, or he even in snapshots he would always have his mouth closed. Or they will tell you things that become very useful to you, and you can ask questions about, you know, what they'd like their teeth to look like in 10 years. And by the way, one of the key points is you're going to find a very low percentage in asking people what they think about their teeth right now. That's a low percentage because they're going to typically say, well, I'd like them to look about like they do now. See, most these people don't perceive a problem. Oh, there isn't a problem, but they don't see a problem. So you always want to ask, what do they want at some point in the future? And, you know, 5-10 year increments are real good because, you see, they will always, in their mind, they're in a dream. Now they're thinking about what will things be like 5-10 years from now. And they will do things to make that happen. Whereas if you start talking about, and I've seen some questions out there that are very much related to the present, and present questions only work if you project out into the future first, get them thinking about 10, 15, 20 years down the road. Now you can bring them back to the future. But I see a lot of people asking questions to dental patients, well, what do you think about your smile? Well, that's a low percentage question. Because if you ask that question to people early on in a conversation, they're going to say, well, it's pretty good the way it is. You know, you've got to get them thinking further down the road, and you've got to get them into the thinking about the situations where their smile's important to them. So the answer to the question, to get the staff involved, you've got to come up with a vision statement, and I think the critical thing there is we teach this in our first seminar. We spend a lot of time with team on this very question, is who are we, what do we do, and for whom do we do it? And those are questions that need to be answered by the doctor. What is it we do? And if the team members see the doctor talking about pathology and looking in people's mouths and giving exams and then telling them what's wrong, what's the staff going to do?
Sure.
They're going to do the same thing, aren't they?
Yep, and that's why you also want them to take courses with you. If you're doing CIRAC, you want to have them go with you.
Exactly.
To see. And also in those programs, I went to a course with Dr. Morin in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget her name, one of his staff, and she would set up a separate session where the dentist would be with the dentist.
Yes.
And then the other staff member would take on our front staff, our receptionists, or our assistants, and take it from there.
You want to get clear out of the dental realm for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You want to get out of the dental realm. You know, I happen to like in talking about a vision statement, you want to get out of the dental. Quit thinking about teeth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want your patients to have objections about teeth, if you want your patients to be thinking about insurance and how much per tooth,
mm-hmm.
then keep talking about teeth. You know, the other night I was watching Larry King live, and he was interviewing Schultz, CEO of Starbucks.
Mm-hmm.
What do you suppose Starbucks' mission statement starts out with? What do you suppose their corporate purpose is?
I'm not sure. They have a very good policy for their staff, giving everyone medical insurance.
Yes, or they're wonderful for employees.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting thing about Starbucks. He says, we're not in the coffee business.
Hmm.
Now think about this. People go to Starbucks and spend $3-4 on a cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm, if not more.
And the average Starbucks customer goes 18 times a month.
Hmm.
So we're talking $75 a month. At Starbucks, that's $900 a year.
Mm-hmm.
That's their average customer profile.
Wow.
Yeah. And their mission statement for their corporate is to enrich the human experience.
Hmm.
Nothing about teeth.
No.
So you see, when they expand the vision statement, when they expand it away from coffee,
mm-hmm.
you think about the way, you know, there are a couple Starbucks I go to on a regular basis. They both happen to be in airports. But they remember me.
Mm-hmm.
And they remember what I always order.
Mm-hmm.
It's always a medium dry cappuccino, two shots. That's what and they know that. They don't have to ask me. They know that. And they make you feel like your family. They make you feel, or at least they portray that to you. And you see, and a coffee is interesting. It's way less than dental work as far as total dollars, But, you know, the average, you think about that, the average Starbucks customer is spending about $900 a year on coffee.
That's amazing.
It's amazing, isn't it?
That's coffee. Imagine if it were dentistry.
If Schultz gets in dentistry, we're in trouble. We better join him. But you see, by not talking about coffee, and they've created this environment where people come in and, well, my daughter did all her pre-dent studying at a Starbucks near Portland State University. She did her homework there. And I said, how can you work in such a noisy place? And she said, well, it makes me focus. But, you see, if we can go on, so let's think about what we are, and if we say something to the effect, and we can even bring it down a little bit to dentistry, but if we are committed to helping people, if we are committed to helping people experience their most potential, if we are committed to helping people get the best treatment possible,
mm-hmm.
and use that as our premise rather than talking about teeth, you know, I've listened to Jeff Bailey talk with patients. I've actually listened to a couple of recordings mm-hmm. of him talking with patients. He spends about an hour with a patient, and, you know, teeth are not a major part of his conversation.
Mm.
That's Lori's job. His job is to find out what people want, and he finds out that people want to look good.
Mm-hmm.
They want to feel good about themselves. Mm-hmm. They don't want dental emergencies, and they want some value. So those basically three things. And he talks about that, and he says, well, tell me a bit more about that. And, you know, since she does primarily cosmetics, it comes up. They want a nice-looking smile, and, of course, he asks them questions about that and what they want. But he also asks questions like, well, when do you think about this the most? Or when did you first become aware that you wanted to do something or you wanted to change your smile? And what he does, he gets them thinking about situations that they're in, whether it be social situations or situations in the workplace or maybe with their family, where they don't feel comfortable about the appearance of their teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And then what he's doing, he's, without actually saying, so how does that make you feel, which I think is, I don't really care for that question quite that way, he gets them thinking about how they feel. I was asking a patient one time, and actually with a role play with a lady who's the wife of a dentist. She wanted to have her teeth whitened, and of course, being Sergeant Schultz, I don't know what whitening is, and so I asked more questions and what she meant by that, and she informed me that she drank red wine, she drinks coffee, and she smokes, and her teeth are brown. And I said, well, let me see, and she said, okay, I see. Now, what I did then is I asked her, when did she first discover that, and when does she think about that? And if you could think back to when's the first time you thought about your teeth being brown, and she says, well, she thinks about it every week as she gets ready to go out. And again, not just saying, well, how do you feel? I said, well, tell me more about that. What do you mean go out? Well, we go out with our friends, and we go to dinner, we play cards, we Western dance, and I see. And so how often do you do that? Well, we do that a couple times a week, and who do you go with? You always go with the same people. So, see, in her own mind, she's thinking about how she feels when she looks in the mirror and she's getting dressed and getting ready to go, and then she looks in the mirror and sees her brown teeth. And so she's thinking about how she feels.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept asking the questions, and I said, well, okay, and any other time in particular when you thought about your brown teeth? And it came out, she said, well, yeah, a couple weeks ago my granddaughter said, Grandma, why are your teeth brown? Now, you don't have to ask her how that made her feel. That is, I mean, she knows how she felt. It felt terrible to have her daughter, granddaughter say, Grandma, why do you look so old? Grandma, why are you so wrinkled? I mean, you don't have to rub it in to make them feel that. And so then I just casually carried on and asked some questions about her grandchildren, how many grandchildren she has, boys or girls, how old they are, how often she sees her grandchildren. And so she's thinking about how she feels as her granddaughter mentioned this, and now the next thing you want to do is you, or somewhere along in this, and these are pretty much in order, what have you tried so far? Well, she told me that she tried bleaching and she tried whitening strips, and you want to find out how those worked, and there are several things important about that. Is one is you want them thinking it didn't work, and the other one is you don't want to suggest something they've already tried and it didn't work. There's no point in suggesting something that somebody else tried and they got no results. I mean, don't think you're going to be the dentist that can that can make it work. And I said, have you tried anything else? And she said, well, yeah, what I do is I don't smile much. Well, there's your answer. I mean, here's your answer. Here's somebody who doesn't smile much. And, you know, that's not unusual. It doesn't take anybody more than a few questions to get to that point. And I said, well, how does that work with your grandchildren? Grandma going around with a long look on her face because she doesn't like her brown teeth, so she doesn't smile. And, well, they could think grandma's not very happy. And I just responded by saying, are you? And it came out that she was a five-year survivor of breast cancer and ecstatic to wake up in the mornings. And I said, so you're a five-year survivor of breast cancer, and because of your brown teeth, you go around this long look on your face, and everybody thinks you're a grumpy old lady. And she says, yeah, I guess that's kind of how it is. Well, you see, there you've got the emotions involved. You now have the emotions involved. And at this point, you see, insurance is no longer an issue. At this point, we're talking about how her granddaughter and her grandson perceive their grandmother and how their friends perceive her as a person. And that has a much stronger emotions than me showing her photographs and explaining to her about her brown teeth and they're worn and how her occlusion is wearing out and how she's now wearing off her front teeth and all that. I mean, this is emotional side of this. You know, a celebrity, actually, that I asked those questions to was a fellow named David Bloom. David Bloom was the he was a young man who died in Iraq of a deep vein thrombosis. He was riding a Humvee hours and hours and hours. But he was on the ABC, on the Today Show, on the weekends, and he was the White House correspondent for a couple of years. He and I sat next to each other on an airplane from Seattle to New York one night, and we got to talking. He was a very personable young man, and we got to talking about what he does, and he'd been interviewing Bill Gates that day, and I learned about how he had gotten into the broadcasting business and how he got his lust for travel was his father used to load him all in the station wagon, haul him all over the United States camping, and, you know, he grew up in Iowa, and anyway, he became a reporter and moved up in the world, and anyway, he was always, as we got talking about what I do, and he said, well, you know, I've always been embarrassed about my crooked teeth, and he smiled real big, and sure enough, his upper anterior teeth are all crowded, and I got to ask him what he's done about it, and he said, well, he's had several consultations, and everybody wants us to put him into 3 years of orthodontics, and he says, they don't ask me what I want. He says, I want them straightened. I can't do that. He says, I make my living. I'm a newscaster. I can't wear braces for 3 years. So anyway, I said, well, what else have you done? And he says, well, I've practiced speaking in front of a mirror so my teeth don't show. Well, these are the kind of things that come out when you start asking questions. And I asked him, and you know my next question. I said, well, how's that work for you? And he said, well, it's working fairly well, but I think I could be more effective if I looked, if I could actually smile more and I could appear lighter in my demeanor. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I referred him to Larry Rosenthal, and he went in and had a consultation, and he ended up going to Iraq, and he died before he got it done. But see, those are the kinds of questions that you ask. Now, going further with these questions, I think a great question is, have you considered how life would be if you had this taken care of? And this is where the photos come in. This is where photos, if you're with the patient and face-to-face, photos are very effective here. And, of course, telling a story about how this patient, similar situation, had something done and how it improved their life. I think a great question that needs to be thrown in here somewhere along in this series of questions is, you know, it sounds like you've done some research on this subject. Where are you in your research? Or you've done some study. Where are you in the research? In other words, have you made a decision to do something along these lines, and now you're looking for a dentist, or are you still making a decision about the procedure? And you see, this is a fork in the road that if they're still thinking about the procedure, your conversation is going to be different than if they've already decided on the procedure, and now they're looking for a dentist. And I've heard several staff members asked this question on the telephone, well, what are you, and the next logical question then is, well, what are you looking for in a dentist? And then you can go ahead and find out, well, what are they looking for? And I heard Rise's receptionist one time ask that question, and the patient wanted somebody who'd had a lot of experience, and she said, well, we've probably done more veneers than anybody in Seattle. Probably true. I'd like somebody who can show me photographs of actual work they've done. And she said, well, we can show you literally hundreds of patients that we've done if you want. And he also said that economics were important. He wondered about how much it would be. And she just right on the telephone, with all the confidence in the world, said, well, you will probably find our estimate will be the highest in Seattle. And what I'd like you to do is go talk to the other two. And he said, I'm checking out three dentists at this point. And this is the person I called via the Internet. And she said, well, I'd like you to go visit the other two dentists first, get their estimates, and then come here. And while our estimate will be higher, I mean, she's just right up front about our estimate will be higher, I promise you that what you experience here will be different than you experience anyplace else. Now, let's pretend. Let's go back to your insurance question for a moment. What if the patient said, well, I want to find out what my insurance will pay on this? So on the telephone, where is she at this point?
Way at the other end.
He's right by.
That's right. I mean, this is not an insurance issue.
Yep.
And now, if the patient were to say something to the effect, well, I can only do what my insurance pays, well, actually, you know, in this case, they were talking about veneers. So we already know the answer, don't we?
Yeah, zero.
I mean, there's not an insurance company in the country that's going to pay for his veneers.
Unless you're an actor.
Or he's an actor, perhaps. Well, it could be. But for most of our patients, let's get it out on the table and say, you know, let's handle it before they even come into the office and say, well, you know, unfortunately, for you, it would be very rare if your insurance company is involved in the cosmetic aspects of dentistry, and they probably won't pay anything. But let me ask you another question. What if they paid the whole thing? What would you do?
Sure, you'd go right ahead.
Oh, you'd go ahead. So really, then, how you can afford this would be the only objection at this point.
Yeah, for some patients it is, but it's a matter of patients value.
It is. And some it's not.
I mean, cars aren't covered by insurance. You have to pay yourself. If you want a nice car, you pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
If you want a nice smile, you want that value, you know.
Well, but we don't want to lecture to them.
No. Mm-mm.
So what we do is by asking questions, you see, we say, well, let's pretend they paid the whole thing. Would there be any other reason that you wouldn't go ahead? Well, what happens at this point is either they say, no, that would be the only issue, and I would even say, are you sure? Because if there are other issues that they haven't really decided to do the procedure, mm-hmm. there's no reason to try and figure out, talk about cost or insurance at this point. Because they are using that simply as an objective or objection to avoid making a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And you can sit down and work out all the financial arrangements in the world and all the ways, all the payment plans and all of the different things you can do, and the answer is still going to be, let me think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're just using that as a dodge. And people use the same thing, and everyone on this call has used the same one that I have used many times. Well, you know, I'm going to have to talk to Carolyn about that. Carolyn's my wife.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how many of us in the call have done that? And bottom line is, it's a decision that we would very easily make by ourselves,
mm-hmm.
except that I don't want to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll pull my wife into this one. And since my wife isn't here, I have to go home and think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't make a sale. So the same thing on that question I like to use. Well, let's pretend. What would you do if your wife said yes? Just ask the question. And then you can explore more of these objections. Now, let's go back to the insurance company for a moment, and if the patient says, well, actually, that's not the issue. Well, now you know now you can say, well, what is it? And then you can find out. If they say, well, if the insurance company paid, if they paid the whole thing, you'd do it. What if they paid nothing? What would you do? And we could make it affordable. So have you thought about a budget for this? And this is where you talk about money. And this can be before they even meet the doctor. You see, this can be on the phone. It can be an initial interview. It can be in the hygiene room on a recall patient. It can be. Let's talk about how much this might be. And everybody in the team, of course, needs to know the fees. And if it's veneers, well, why don't you smile, big smile in the mirror? Let's count the teeth. How many it would take? And that's real simple to multiply that veneer fee by 10 and add a little bit for contingencies and say it's going to be approximately, you fill in the blank, how much is this going to be? And the response may be, wow, that's a lot of money. And, well, let's don't drop it. Yes, it is a lot of money. How do you normally pay for something that costs this much? I make payments. Would you like to do that here? And you go ahead, and sometimes, and this is how I've heard some of the receptionists I work with that have actually done this step on the telephone before the patient actually shows up. And since we're talking about a couple people in our book, I've heard both Rise Spores receptionist Maria and I've heard Jeff Bailey do this on the telephone with patients. And if you think about their practice for a moment, they're in Boulder, Colorado. Most of their patients are driving out from Denver. It's 45 minutes to an hour drive just one way to their office. And so he gets this all done before they drive out there. And let's say the patient shows up in the office with a line of credit set up for enough to cover the treatment before they even come to the office. What do you suppose your percentage of acceptance is going to be?
Mm-hmm. Very high. But a lot of people will say, talk about money last.
And you know what I say about that?
What?
They're wrong. How's that for a quick answer?
A good one. I think it's a matter of creating the value.
Yeah.
And getting inside their psyche and saying,
you've got to ask, but you see, you don't do that by lecturing.
No.
You do that by asking questions.
Sure.
And getting them to get inside their psyche. You're getting them to figure out why they want it so badly. You see, it's about selling dreams.
Mm-hmm.
There's a fellow that's president of Ferrari North America.
Mm-hmm.
And his title, his book is actually Selling Dreams. Why would anybody buy a Ferrari? Peter, you bought one once. Why would anybody buy a Ferrari? Not transportation, is it? Peter Munton, who's on the call, had a Ferrari for a while, and he took me to the airport one time. The car is like a go-kart. Now, it's really neat looking. I really felt cool pulling up in the airport. The only problem is I had to carry my suitcase in my lap. Remember that, Peter?
I do, Bill. Sorry, I was on mute for there for a moment.
And the other thing about the Ferrari was he was in a parking garage in a hotel, and he starts up the engine in this thing. I mean, it is. I mean, if you like cars that make noise and make smoke. Now, I'm not to imply that his car was smoking. My gosh, it made so much noise it was setting off burglar alarms and all the other cars in the garage. Now, it was cool pulling out, but why would people buy a Ferrari? Well, this guy got it right. They're buying a dream, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
They're buying a dream about what this product will do for them, and I remind you that that's why we buy everything. It's what it's going to do for me. And that's how you've got to get inside their head, inside their psyche, and let them build the value. And what we've done in dentistry is we try to inflict our value system on them
mm-hmm.
and tell them why we would value that treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't work. And so that's why I say talk about money up front is once you do this. Now think about another example. When you go to a realtor to buy a house, when do they start talking money?
Sure. What are you looking for?
What's your price range?
Yep.
And they don't go out and show you homes that are way above or way below your price range because
mm-hmm.
they know they'd be either embarrassing you or making you angry or something, so they ask that question. You buy a gift for someone. What's the question? Within minutes.
Price range.
Your price range. And so I say that question about getting money up front is real important, because if they're not interested in money, they're probably not going to buy. Our dealers discovered this. They put the sticker price in the back window.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the sticker price and then go open the driver's side door, there'll be a salesman by your side in about 2 seconds because he knows you're in the ballpark
mm-hmm.
and you're still interested. So I say bring money up early,
mm-hmm.
and it does work. So then the close is real simple. After you've talked about money, talked about how to pay for it, and notice insurance does. So if insurance comes up,
mm-hmm.
you just handle it
mm-hmm.
early on.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, you handle it and you deal with it and say, well, your insurance will pay about $1,000 maximum. Probably a more important question would be, how do you want to handle the balance?
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to do it one tooth at a time because their insurance will pay that much, the response always is, we can do that. In your particular case, one tooth a year, it's going to take you approximately 20 years to do this. Given that I'm 63, I want you to understand I'm going to be 83 years old and I'll do your last crown for you. And I'd play with them.
Mm-hmm.
I'd play with them that way.
Mm-hmm.
I just never. So, any other questions? Well, I want to invite all of you. If you're interested in what we do, we coach doctors, Mike Bannon and David Nelson. You're already working with us, and we welcome you in our coaching program. But what I do is I coach doctors and staffs on these issues: leadership, profitability, and of course, profitability always boils down to how to sell the bigger case. An exercise I encourage all of you to do, whether you do work with us or not, is work with your team on the bigger question, on, you know, what is it you're trying to do? And the less you talk about dentistry, the better off you'll be on that. So I want to thank you all very much. Is anybody from Quality here yet? I guess they didn't come on the call tonight. Well, I want to thank them again for getting people on the call and thank my people. I want to thank all the doctors for taking an hour out of your evening. I know we probably couldn't have had this call last night right during that final football game.
Bill, can I ask you a question?
Go ahead.
This is Mike Folley. I understand you've got a coaching program. Do you have individual seminars outside of that, or is it all inclusive?
You know, I do some individual seminars for various groups, but I'm not doing very many. I'm speaking this year at the ADA in October. I'm speaking at the AECD in May in Atlanta. I'm speaking in New Orleans meeting.
Chicago Midwinter.
I'm speaking three times at Chicago Midwinter meeting. So I generally do those seminars like that.
That's great. Do you ever come to Canada and talk?
I do. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be in Toronto on March 16th.
March 16th?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, great.
And Dr. Blatchford, this is Lisa from Rocket Dog. I would be remiss if I didn't say that marketing certainly helps with that perceived value when you're building that up.
Well, that's right. And one of the things that I'll point out, and Lisa, I appreciate you saying that. See, one of the problems that we have in dentistry is we get people into the office under one premise, and then we try to do something else. And if we're using the insurance company for our marketing program by signing up for their programs and the patients are attracted to us because we discount the fees, remember, when that patient comes to the office, the reason they came to see us was our name was on a list of discounted fees. Therefore, I'm here. And that patient is probably not going to be your best patient. Now, if a patient has come to you because of your marketing and marketing value and marketing the things that people want from an emotional point of view, you get a different patient in the office, and there's certainly a lot to that.
Mm-hmm.
People don't show up in a Mercedes dealership looking for an inexpensive automobile.
And they're doing a lot of research online, having a great website.
That's right. Websites today, we have clients that are actually getting, we have a couple clients who are getting over $100,000 a month just from their website. So websites are critical. Thanks, Lisa.
You bet.
Okay, anything else?
No, that was very good.
Well, thank you very much for being on the call tonight. And when you get a call from one of our consultants, at least return the call. If you're interested in our program, say yes. And if you're not interested, just have the courtesy to say, no, I'm not interested. But please return the call. Thank you very much. And thanks
great.
All of you for being here.
Night.